Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
It's Slate Night, the Film Fan Podcast. Now, here are your hosts, Corey and Mason.
Hello and welcome to Slate Night, the Film Fan Podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Mason Schmidt, here with my best bud, Corey Knudsen.
Got it right this week.
Got it right this week on the second attempt.
It's exciting.
As well. Yeah, big moves here. We already cracked into a couple of kind of big waves, but we'll be talking about what movies we've seen this past week, as well as looking into the upcoming new releases that are on the horizon, and then diving into a little bit of the new notable developments within the world of movies as well. Corey, how you been?
Been good. You already mentioned we got some Kona Big Waves here. Yep. Classic drink. It says Liquid Aloha. Couldn't have said it better myself. That's
You're such a fucking tool.
That's great. I actually have... we did an unboxing a couple weeks ago, or I did, of my McDonald's thing. I have a more related one that I actually want you to open up. I haven't told you about this. No, this is a good thing. It's not creepy. You're looking at me weird. It's not weird.
Scary.
This is something that is upcoming next year. And I didn't know if we were going to get this or not. I don't think everybody got this, but I want you to open it up.
What does that mean? What do you mean? I don't think...
Once you...
Oh! Maybe I do know. Maybe I... I feel like I have a guess at what the hell you're talking about now. Does this have to do with Shelby Oaks? No?
It does not.
Okay, that was my only...
I just wanted you to see this.
Ooh! This is sick! For those who are just listening on the podcast, this is our tickets for the Odyssey. I'm guessing.
So it's... When I ordered, we mentioned a while back that we got tickets for 70mm IMAX to see the Odyssey in Michigan next week or next year. And when I ordered the tickets, they said, like, if you order these, like, you get entered into a chance to get a commemorative ticket for it. And I don't know, like, if everybody that got them, like, got this ticket, but show it to the camera there. It's pretty sick. It's pretty sweet. So it says first screening on there, IMAX 70mm.
I actually have no idea what all is in frame, so I'm going to hold it right here. This is awesome.
So then it says, like, the actual theater at the bottom, Celebration Cinema. So I was stoked when I saw
it.
This
is so cool. Holy shit.
So I was excited. I
have to put that up somewhere.
Yeah, man. I think we can get a frame for it and toss it up. But
it's going to be the weirdest fucking frame that fits that. But
yeah, so we'll see. But pretty cool to get in the mail. I got, like, a notification. I got a package, and I'm like, I didn't order anything. Like, so I think it's this.
It's a bomb.
So, yeah. So,
this is sick.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. I wanted to save that to show you this week, but I cannot wait to go see that. But happy that we got a little commemorative ticket.
Did we decide if we're going to drive or fly? Because that's
I feel like driving. Yeah. I feel like a good little road trip out there. Sweet. Stop at some spots along the way. Chicago, maybe.
Yeah.
That could be fun. So, yeah, that's my more relevant unboxing than a McDonald's.
I like this one more.
Yeah, crazy.
Those are really sweet. I didn't know that. I don't even remember if you mentioned that to me, that they'd send out, like, a commemorative ticket.
But I didn't want to, like, get your hopes up or anything, so I wanted to keep that. But anyways, getting into movies from this week, the big release was The Conjuring Last Rites, which is supposedly maybe the last movie in The Conjuring universe.
Yeah.
Certainly feels like it from the way that this movie ended. And I've enjoyed the franchise leading up to this. There's been a few low points. Some of the Annabelle movies, the first Nun, Curse of La Llorona, which we have up over there. There's a few middling points. But overall, I think a pretty solid franchise. The first three Conjuring movies I like a lot. Yep. Annabelle Creation's really good. The Nun 2, really good as well. So, solid franchise. And this is one we mentioned last week. We're both, like, relatively excited for, just to see kind of how it wraps up. And this is, Ed and Lorraine Warren are taking on another case, and one that is, again, based on a true story. I don't know how much of it actually is true.
Yeah.
You know, if an actual devil mirror was, like, you know, running at him down a hallway.
sprinting down a hallway.
Yeah, at sideways angle, which is crazy. Yeah. But you get Vera Farmiga and Patrick Wilson back in this movie as Ed and Lorraine Warren, which that's the thing that has always kind of carried these movies for me and elevated them above other ones, is that that relationship is so much fun to be with those characters and just going on this journey. And knowing that there is an element of truth to it as well, where, like, a lot of these things are based on true stories, and then they obviously extrapolate it for movies, yeah. But just that air of truth is nice, and then their relationship is really sweet, too. I've always just enjoyed them kind of having their, you know, flirting while there's just these things, crazy, horrific things going on around them.
There's always a moment of downtime where they, like, get away and, like, a big climactic thing happened at the house of wherever this exorcism or possession is happening, and they just are like...
Yeah, it just reminds me of, like, our daughter. They'll just have, like, a... That sounds like a mocking, but they'll have, like, a sweet moment where I'm like, oh, yeah, I actually really like this couple in this film, and I buy into their relationship. It always has worked. And I'm a big fan of the Conjuring, like, mainline movies, more so than the kind of superlative, like, Nun, Annabelle stuff. I haven't seen all of those. I have seen The Nun 2, which also was directed by Michael Chaves. Loved that movie. Was really surprised by that, but... I think that this mainline Conjuring franchise has really handled a lot of, like, the good human and relationship moments where you kind of miss that sometimes in horror films.
Mm-hmm. Oh, we certainly get that in this movie with their daughter in the movie. We've seen her in a couple of the other ones, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But this one, she gets a bigger role where she's starting to kind of get visions of her own, like her mom. And she becomes a bigger part of the story at the end, too.
Yeah.
And I enjoyed seeing that. And again, like, this movie, I think... struggles a bit in the first half where it really is like two different movies, where one you get the haunted house element, like this family in Pennsylvania, I think it is, and it's very much like Conjuring 2, had the same like kind of setting and feel to it a little bit. some good scares in there, which I liked, and then you get a lot of the Warrens doing kind of family stuff, and the daughter's getting engaged, and you get the son-in-law, which I actually really liked his character too.
Oh yeah, Ben Hardy.
Yeah, I thought he was great. And so you get a lot of that, and then they all kind of come together at the house. It just takes a little bit too long to get there, I think. But even so, I enjoyed, like, all of the elements of this movie. I was just, like, having a really good time. It was a, like, kind of chilly fall morning when I saw it, and I was just like, I don't know, I was in the right mood.
Yeah.
It's, like, the first weekend of September, too. I think this is a perfect movie to, like, get me into spooky season. I know you've been doing some, like, August watches, but for me, like, this was the one where I was like, oh, this is a great little just entry point into that. And I think that the, like I mentioned, the relationship between the characters always carries these movies. It's never really scary. Like we've mentioned in a lot of weeks where like a lot of modern horror movies aren't like super memorable in the scares. I think there are a few good moments, a couple good like tension filled scenes. That's what the Conjuring movies have been good at, I think, is tension filled stuff. One in like a dressing room with like mirrors all around.
Yeah,
I
thought that was in the trailers. Yeah, that's pretty good.
So some cool shots in there. Obviously some cool shots in the house and just some kind of disturbing imagery for sure. But I don't know. I had a really good time with this one. I thought it was a really nice kind of ending to this franchise. It was kind of bittersweet at the end. I was like getting a little sad. I was like, well, I didn't expect the Conjuring movies to make me feel like, wow, I've been on this journey with these characters. And it kind of ends at this nice wedding with, like, Ed and Lorraine, and it's just,
James Wan in the background, he's in attendance at this wedding.
Yeah, and you get some cameos from the other three Conjuring movies, too, which is just a nice little flavor to it, and just, I don't know, I had a really fun time with it. It's nothing groundbreaking in the horror genre, but I'd probably give this movie, like, a B. I think it's really solid. I had a good time with it. I don't think there's too many major negatives, for me, at least.
Yeah, no, I'm right there with you. I gave it a C-plus in my review, and it's not that, like, there's no big overarching, like, negative I have with this movie. Like I said, I'm a fan of these Conjuring films. I've never thought that any of them have been scary. I remember when the first one came out, people were like, oh, this is like one of the best, scariest horror films we've had in recent memory. And I was like, yeah, it's good. It's another possession, another haunting movie, and I do really dig it. But I've gone back to this franchise again and again, specifically for the dynamic between Patrick Wilson and Vera Farmiga as Ed and Lorraine. They're so great. And like I said, you get a lot of good emotional and like relationship-based moments between those characters, and you can really feel the trust and love that they have for each other. So it's always like, it's a component that I don't get in a lot of other horror material that I really appreciate here, and it kind of smooths over some of the hard edges of this movie or the things I might not like. I will say the opening of this movie, floored me. It's a flashback to the birth of their daughter and the complications that came with the birth. And I remember watching the movie and I was just like so uncomfortable. I was so upset and I was like, I know that they have a daughter in this universe and they have a daughter in the real world. Like, I get that. But I was like, if they lose this baby in this sequence, I'm leaving. Not that, like, that's something, like, I remember growing up and I would be able to watch the most, like, heinous and violent shit and it wouldn't get to me. Seeing stuff like that now that I'm married, I'm just like, I'm getting sad watching this. And I whispered to my wife, because her and I saw it together, and I was like, we might, like, I know that they have a kid and, like, but this could have been a prior pregnancy that didn't maybe go the full term or something or whatever. And I'm like, if this doesn't work out, we might be leaving. Like, I can't stomach this. But it goes well. Baby's born, and then we get a lot of her character within the present day, or at least present day within this film, which is in the 80s. And I really appreciated that dynamic and having more of the daughter having a role, and then also the give and take between, like, oh, the daughter has a fiance or a boyfriend that's going to propose, and the friction that comes with that. And I like seeing, like, Ed as, like, the patriarchal, like, okay, like, fuck, we're going to play ping pong, actually, and we'll see if you can be a part of this family. Like, I like that kind of camaraderie. This one was, not that any of these have been super scary to me, I think this one has been the least, or at least I think the least effective in the scares it sets out to do, because it does kind of boil down to just a lot of the jump scare type of formulaic kind of stuff you get with these films. It does kind of at a point start to follow a formula. It does also have, it's a war of two halves, because you have, like you said, the story that is really about the Warren family, and then we have the haunting story. And once they kind of dip into each other and we get to that kind of third act where we're in the house with the haunting, it's like, okay, now we're back into like a Conjuring film. I had a good time. Yeah, it does kind of fall into a lot of the stuff that we've seen in the, or like I remember in Conjuring 2, kind of like you're saying, because it is that similar type of haunting, and you get the same shots of like, oh, the family's out of the house and they're all looking at the house and they're wondering if they're gonna get the kids out or if this demonic possessed object is gonna get destroyed or what's gonna happen. And while it wasn't like innovative really at all, it was still very watchable for me and I really enjoyed it. If I was gonna, like, I know, I feel like you and I would probably rank these films similarly, at least these four Conjuring films. It's like, I can't even really differentiate a whole lot between the first two films in terms of which one I think is better. I think I personally like the second one better. But, like, I would, if I was going to rank them, I'd go 2-1, and then I'd just do Devil Made Me Do It and Last Rites even in the third spot tied, because they feel, like, quality-wise, they all feel kind of similar. Mm-hmm. The first two are excellent, very well done, and very effective. These latter two, I think they're pretty well done, and they're, they teeter-totter on effectiveness in terms of the scares, but I still overall really enjoy them, and I think that they're not like the ugly stepchild of the Conjuring universe. I think that they belong with those first two. It's just, first two are great. The third and fourth film, they're a step down, but they're still really good. So mm-hmm. I really enjoy this. It was kind of like what you said. It was a great way to set up September and get us into spooky season. Also, the movie's making bank right now, which I think this is a Warner Brothers release, so this will be, what, the seventh release from Warner Brothers in a row that will make over $40 million at the box office, so that's also really interesting and exciting. So,
want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
I had a pretty great time with this movie, and I'm happy that you were able to see it this week as well. Do you have a ranking of the four, or would you kind of echo a lot of the same sentiment I have with how they break down, at least in quality.
Yeah, I'm kind of in the same boat where, like, the first two are great. Mm-hmm. The third and fourth are still really solid. I enjoy them, but, you know, many franchises get a lot worse than this, you know, as far as, like, third and fourth movies go. I would go 1, 2, 4, then 3. Okay. But, like, again, 1 and 2 are pretty close. 3 and 4 are pretty close. But, yeah, just kind of last points on, like, what you mentioned about going back to, like, the birth of their daughter. And, like, it felt like a nice way to have a full circle moment of, like, their first case and then kind of tying into their last case that they did with this, like, mirror that was kind of connected with their daughter's birth. I thought that was a nice way to do it. I also have really liked the time period that all the Conjuring movies are in, of, like, the 70s and kind of the 80s in this one. Yeah. I just like the costumes and production
design. The sideburns and the brown, like, jackets and, like,
And just, like, even there's a scene where, like, a girl's, like, going back on a, like, VHS tape trying to find something, like, a face in there. I always like scenes like that where, like, somebody's, like, playing, replaying, replaying, replaying.
They're trying to pause it at the exact moment. It's like, I remember having to do shit like that.
Yeah.
And so, that was on a DVD, not a VHS. Just, like, stuff like that.
Yeah. So, I think Michael Chavez, who has done a lot of the last few Conjuring movies with Devil Made Me Do It, like you said, he did Curse of La Llorona and The Nun 2. It feels like he's been getting more confident as a director, especially with, like, Nun 2 and this one. It feels like he's taken that next step. The last thing I want to mention is that there's one scene in this movie that feels weirdly out of place, and it's with Annabelle in the last act of the movie, where it's concerning the Warren's daughter, and it just kind of gets really big in CGI for a second, and it's not directly tied to the main, like,
haunting,
like, artifact or haunting or whatever. I'm like, this feels like a, we kind of want to have Annabelle in one of our last movies. I'm like, I could have done without that. It's a pretty brief scene, but it just felt a little bit out of place and just kind of like franchise-y stuff.
Yeah, there's a lot of things that within these four films, I'm like, why do we keep going into this fucking artifact room? And then in this movie, you have Ed bringing, like, they have a house party, and Ed's like, all right, here's the room.
Don't touch anything.
These are all the artifacts. These are all the things. Like, they're all haunted. They need to stay here, which I like that reasoning of, like, you can't destroy it. Like, sometimes destroying it makes it worse, so we just, it's better to keep it locked up here and safe from everyone else. And I really, I dug this movie, and I dug kind of how they handled the characters and where they resolved the story, and from how it feels, it does feel like a pretty good fitting end to these characters, which is just weird, because, like, after finishing it, I started looking back at just even, like, photos of the originals, or the originals, it makes it sound like they're 90 years old, but the first film, and seeing just how young Vera Farmiga and Patrick Wilson look in those films compared to this one. I was like, oh my god, we've had this franchise going for over 13 years now? So it's just like, wow. It's so crazy. And it's a pretty consistent horror franchise. So at least this main line is. I did really enjoy it. I'd recommend going to see it, as the box office numbers are kind of being boosted right now, so that's great. But yeah, it was a good time. It's a pretty good fitting end. I do kind of agree with the Annabelle thing. I'm like, this just feels like you wanted to have your mainstay, big poster child, scary artifact in this movie a little bit more. And it felt like the Pennywise thing in It Chapter 1 when they're watching the projectors and then they, like, flashes and Pennywise is big there. And it just, I was like, okay, I kind of get what you're going for, but I'm like, I don't see how this really connects to what's going on, but fine. But yeah, it's a great time at the theaters. Even if it's not necessarily the best of the franchise, it's still a worthy watch. A film that I said last week I started watching, said last week as well that I was not going to finish watching, but then actually right after recording, I went back to my apartment and my wife was watching it, so I was like, fuck it, I'm going to finish it. I watched K-Pop Demon Hunters, finished it. I don't have a whole lot to say other than, hey, the music is somewhat good. The animation, I don't mind. It's actually pretty, it's fun to look at. I don't give a shit about any of the characters within this film. I don't give a shit about any of the story. I don't think any of it is really that inventive. It feels very formulaic. Aside from that, I'm happy that it's getting all the success that it's getting. We've talked about the fact that it's going to get a sequel here soon, too. It's just not a movie for me. I think it's completely fine. It's pretty harmless in terms of quality. But some of the songs, they're earwormy, and I've had a couple of them stuck in my head, so I'm not going to drag the movie because I don't think it's a piece of shit. It's just now I'm getting, I've seen it. I've seen the water cooler movie. Now I'm ready to move past this one. And I'm like, people just, it's blowing up to a point where I'm like, I need to get away from this movie. And I'm getting more annoyed by the staying power of the movie than I am by the actual, like, quality, where I'm like, this movie's like nothing really to me. But it's just everyone keeps talking about it. I'm like, oh my God, can we move on from K-Pop Demon Hunters? But yeah, I did watch it. I kind of get some of the hype. It is, like, it's a very watchable movie. I just didn't have any, like, big connection to it or hard, really, feelings about it. Just didn't really care much for it. Music's fine. Corey, I know you're never going to watch it. If you do, I'm sure you're going to echo or maybe hate it more, maybe not. I don't know.
If it gets Oscar nominations or a lot of award season stuff, then I will probably check it out, but there's just a lot of other things I want
to
watch.
Yeah, I'm still massively in support. If it comes to the Oscars and we're getting kind of best original song nominations, if this gets one or two nominees, I'd be like, yep, works for me. Okay. Because some of the songs are really good. I don't mind them.
Yeah.
Just the movie overall, I'm like, nah, it's fine.
Yeah.
I think that's it.
An exciting thing that Mason and I went and saw earlier this week,
the best thing we saw this week,
kind of just was a last minute thing that we're like, yeah, let's go see it, was Jaws, the 50th anniversary re-release. We saw it in IMAX, which, this movie looks so good.
Perfect.
Obviously, it came out in 1975, and this movie is, I think, my third favorite movie of all time. It's definitely in my top five. We've got the poster up over here. That we recently added, and this still holds up as just one of the best movies of all time.
Oh, yeah.
Just any angle that you want to come at it from, of adapting, you know, the book into the script by Peter Benchley. He did both the book and was a co-writer on it. From Steven Spielberg's direction, we talked a few weeks ago about the blocking and framing in High and Low. This movie also has incredible blocking and framing, and it just feels like something that is very old school, and I wish we could see more of, instead of all these like quick rapid cuts. But there's so many scenes that are like long takes in this movie that are like oneers, they would probably be like marketed as now, but they're just so natural and effortless, of just like somebody going into a house, going outside, and then there's like a big billboard underneath there, and you just stay with the characters as it's going, and you don't even really notice that it's a oneer, not like the Extraction movies or like 1917 or something, where like those movies do it great as well, but this is just a very effortless way of doing it. And just knowing that there was so many issues with the production of Jaws and how this movie looks like it was made just like so cleanly is amazing to me. The cast of this movie is great. I mean, that main trio of Roy Scheider, Robert Shaw, Richard Dreyfuss, once they get on that boat and they're just the boys on the boat hunting a shark, and they all have such different personalities, and they bring something different to the table that helps them in this adventure. It is so great to see. Richard Dreyfuss is just this fun little, like, kind of nerdy guy. Robert Shaw is just this hardened, like, sea veteran who's just got his crusty old boat, and he does whatever. Roy Scheider's kind of, he's the police chief of the town, so he wants to do things by the books and all that. So it's a great mix of characters. It's obviously the, you know, not showing the shark as much is great in hindsight. They didn't really plan on doing that. The shark just wasn't working.
Yeah.
So they couldn't do it, but it turned out to be great. And it is amazing just watching the movie again and seeing how little of it we actually see until like the final like few minutes.
Yeah.
But it is just like the score by John Williams that sets it up so well. Mm. Just little visuals that you see of, you know, even just a fin or whatever it is. So I am in love with this movie. I'm so happy I got to see it in theaters. It was just a great experience in the theater too. Like with re-releases, I feel like people are more like, everyone who wants to be there, like really wants to be there and is like respectful, not on their phones, not talking. They're just like, yeah, we want to go see Jaws.
I could have saw this movie at home yesterday, but I chose to come see it in theaters with a group of people that are just big fans of this film.
Mm-hmm.
Roy Scheider, Robert Shaw, Richard Dreyfuss, like you said, an amazing trio. Robert Shaw is one of my favorite performances ever in all of film in this movie as Quint. I love him. His introduction scene is maybe my favorite scene in the entire movie when he just nails on a chalkboard. I love the fact that he took the time to draw a shark eating someone on the chalkboard too before he fucking started scratching. But in that scene, and you get like the basically like a council meeting of a lot of the city or a lot of the town meeting up, like, what's going on? Do we need to close the beach? And the mayor's just like, well, we're not going to close the beach. Come on. It's the summer. Come on.
Good Murray Hamilton impression. Nice.
I tried.
you're right over there?
I drank too hard.
Wow. Okay. You drank too hard? Yeah, I've been there, done that.
But Richard Dreyfuss as just like this really eager, interested, like, science, coming at it from, like, a scientific lens, whereas Robert Shaw's like, no, we're just hunting a beast, and we're going after him. And you would never, watching it, not knowing, like, or if you didn't know that they had issues with the shark, it works so perfectly how little we do see of it. And it builds up to that big, show me the gas tank. Come on, show me a mountain. Like, it's just so perfectly handled. I love that. Also, this is a side note, a complete tangent, but for the show notes, we always put directed by the name of the director, and then we'll list notable, like, fucking films that they've made. So directed by Steven Spielberg. Corey put the show notes in for this one. He said, The Sugarland Express, 1941, always in the BFG. Obviously the films that you know Steven Spielberg
right.
for. But this is maybe, I don't know if it's my favorite Spielberg, but it's up there. It's just so effective in everything it sets out to do. And with how little we see of the shark, you don't really notice it because of how interesting and how interesting the characters are and how invested you are in them trying to figure this out for the town. And it's also them getting drunk and exchanging stories about Ooh. Scars and shit on the ship is so fun.
The USS yeah. Indianapolis speech is just, like, mesmerizing.
Oh, again, one of my favorite performances, one of the best monologues in mm-hmm. film history. So seeing this, like, I wish I was alive in the 70s. To be able to go see this in theaters and, yeah, you don't see the shark a whole lot, but to see him, my dumb ass would be like, how the hell did they train a shark to do this? Like, I wouldn't think that they had the technology or the warehouse to be able to figure that out and do that on screen, and it just works so well. It stands the test of time. It never feels dated. It's just intoxicatingly watchable. And yeah, it's no notes. Like, it is, watching it again in theaters, I'm like, this movie is literally, not that there's a perfect movie, but if there is, it's Jaws. And as yeah. like, my introduction to Jaws was from the movie The Ringer with Johnny Knoxville, where one of the guys is like, name any movie, mention any movie to me and I'll tell you about it. And they're like, Jaws. He's like, great movie. And that's it. That's all he says. And I was just like, okay, I saw that really, like, when I was really young, and then growing up, finally seeing Jaws, I love this movie. Yeah, and it was, like you said, it was so nice to see this in a theater with fans of this. It was the most loving viewing of a movie you could go to, is when you go to a fan screening of something that's been out for a while, and now it's just remastered and released back into cinema. So it was a great watch. I, like you said, the score is fantastic. Everything about this movie is just a classic and
iconic. There's a few things that stood out to me on a rewatch. I hadn't seen it in a few years, but one is...
AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's RUBRIK.com.
Is how funny the movie is.
Oh, yeah.
I always forget that. And there's, like, just so many good little quips from everybody. And we were talking about it walking out of the theater.
Richard Dreyfuss.
He has so many great lines. And, like, when they're on the boat and, it, like, the shark takes out the power, he's like, the shark ate the lights.
He ate the lights.
Or even Lorraine Gary, who's also great in this movie, is the mom. Like, she's like, oh, the kid's on the boat. Like, he's fine. Sees the picture of the shark, like, in the book, eating the boat. She's like, get off the boat now.
Listen to your father.
Yeah. So, just a lot of good moments that break up that tension, but don't feel like they compromise the rest of the movie. And just the other thing that I kind of noticed was how a lot of my favorite scenes in this movie don't have the shark at all.
Mm-hmm.
One of my favorites is a dinner scene that starts off with Roy Scheider and his son sitting at the table. And, like, Roy Scheider is sitting with his hands and just kind of, like, he's very stressed about the town, like, closing the beaches. He's trying to figure that out. He's just, like, moving his hands, and his son is just mimicking what he's doing. And he doesn't notice it at first, but then he, like, kind of knowingly does it. And it's such a sweet moment. And then, you know, it kind of ends with him being like to his son, like, give me a kiss. And he's like, why? He's like, we need it.
Yeah.
It's such a sweet moment. And then it directly leads into Richard Dreyfuss coming over and, like, bringing a bottle of wine and, like, just a good comedic scene between the
bringing three. Two bottles of wine. I don't know which one you take.
He's like, are you going to eat that food?
Yeah.
Like, he just takes it.
The plate.
And it's just, and that scene even starts out with Richard Dreyfuss coming in after, like, this really stressful day. And he's like, to Roy Scheider, like, how's your day been?
Yeah,
and they just, like, kind of laugh it up. They just chuckle. It's, like, great humor, great family dynamics with, like, Chief Brody and his family that just make this movie so, so perfect. I genuinely think this is a perfect movie. I don't have a flaw with it. I love it so much. It was great to see it in IMAX. It looked incredible, but they also kept the grain of the 70s, which I was happy about, because some re-releases try and, like, make it so, like, bright and pop, and it's like, I don't want that. I want it to feel like it was, but just for an updated screening of the movie. So if you haven't seen Jaws, definitely watch this movie. It's great. I mean, there's a lot of classics we haven't seen, so I know some people just haven't seen Jaws. If you're able to catch it in theaters, it looks incredible. If you have seen the movie and you want to see it in theaters, it may still be there, so go check it out because it's definitely worth it. It's one of the most important movies of all time, one of my favorites that I just keep. When I think of film, when I think of movies, I think of Jaws. It's amazing. I love this movie. And it was just fun seeing it with you too. I had a great time.
Yeah, it was awesome. And like, this is a movie that if it was it could be released today. And aside from maybe like the aesthetics of it and just the overall look and like the grain and all that, it holds up so substantially well. It's so well done. And I also want, the biggest surprise for me is how violent and aggressive this movie is. And it's like PG, but it's also in the era of where there wasn't a PG-13, and it's not quite an R rating, but so we're just going to do parental guidance. And then PG-13 comes out in the 80s, and I feel like this would probably line into a PG-13, but just some of the attacks and some of the stuff that you see, and not only that, but the fear that this film puts within the viewer when we have the buildup of the John Williams score leading into the shark, and then we have a shark attack, we have someone flailing in the water, and everyone's like, oh, what's going on? Are they having fun? And oh, that, and then like the water's red, and it's just, it surprises me every time. I'm like, I forget how fucking baller this movie gets, and how willing it is to just, you know what? Here it is. Here's the blood. Someone's getting mauled, and like the scene with, I forget the kid that gets killed, but the mother, goes up and confronts Roy Scheider, and she's like, so I heard that there was an attack the day prior. You could have had a way of stopping this from happening to my son, basically. And just smacks him. And he just stands there and takes it because he's like, yeah, I am at fault. Like, you're 100% right. And it's just, there are so many great scenes that I'm like, every character has a reason and a right to feel the way that they feel in this. And they have a good, like, it's just so well written. And it works. It just, like Corey said, if you haven't seen it, you need to see it. And I'm not one of those people that's like, oh, you need to see this movie, because I hate it when people do it to me. But Jaws is one of those where I'm like, do it as fast as you can. See this movie as fast as you can if you haven't. And if you have seen it, rewatch it. Re-remember how awesome it is, because it, like Corey said, it is one of those perfect movies that I would be like, yeah, needs to be like, that is, if there's a vault that we need a fucking time capsule save for the end of the world, Jaws deserves to be in that vault.
Yeah.
And it is perfect.
There's very few, there's a lot of movies that get into pop culture and have a moment, but not a lot of movies have a direct tie to like an activity you do.
Yeah.
Anytime you go swimming, even as a kid, if you haven't seen Jaws, but like one of your buddies is like, like everybody knows what that is.
Even without seeing the movie, you know that.
And like, even as a kid too, like, so, like, when I'd go up to my cabin just in the lake, I'm just, like, swimming around. I'm like, oh, I'm a little uneasy right now. I'm just, like, after watching the movie for the first time. So, it's just, like, very rare that a movie, like, drives its way into, like, a very normal activity that you do, like, aside from just the big pop culture, you know, part of it.
Well,
so
that and being, like, the first summer blockbuster and having all of the legacy that that spans. But not only that, the production, talking about the shark failing, like, everyone, not everyone knows about that, but that is so infamous to the point where it's so recognizable. And the production of Jaws and what basically went down, and Spielberg just having to try and fumble fuck his way through figuring this movie out. It's everything about it just works, and it's so iconic. So Jaws is awesome. It was so cool. It was the best movie I got to see in theaters this past week, which I wouldn't have thought of a movie from 1975, but it was just so sweet seeing this, and I'm really happy to, like you said, on a whim, hey, there's 4 o'clock, Jaws? Yeah, let's go see it.
Yeah.
Why not? It was awesome. One of the movies that I watched this week for the first time is a movie that I was intrigued by, not super excited about, because I completely forgot that it was coming out at all this year, mostly because it was a straight streaming release, and whenever that happens, I'm just like, that's like a made-for-TV movie. It's not that important. But The Thursday Murder Club came out. It's based on a book by Richard Osment, which my wife read the book. It's a cool little murder mystery kind of story about these retirees living in this assisted living or like retirement home, and on Thursdays they get to rent out this room in the facility, and they just unpack and try and solve cold cases and try and work through mysteries and stuff like that. The biggest, like, that story, that kind of synopsis, already kind of, I'm interested. Then you attach Chris Columbus to it. director of Home Alone and Harry Potter, Sorcerer's Stone, and many other things, but just someone that is so well in line with making great, iconic cinema, and also just with that, his films that he make, Home Alone, has a texture to it. It has, like, a tangibility. It has, like, a cool feel to it. So you got Chris Columbus behind the camera. Then you have a cast of Helen Mirren, Pierce Brosnan, Ben Kingsley, Celia Imrie, Tom Ellis, and Jonathan Pryce. Like, it is a stacked cast for a Netflix film. This movie bored the living shit out of me. The mystery is not that compelling. The intrigue is nowhere to be found. With it being a Netflix straight-to-streaming release, it looks like a Netflix straight-to-streaming release. Like, every Netflix movie looks the exact same. There's no, like, tangibility to the frame. Like, there's nothing feels real. Like, it's just so flatly lit. Everything has just, like, realistic coloring. Like, there's no style in anything that you get to see. And it just, every movie on Netflix that's a Netflix original, they all look the same. And it's just so fucking boring. I remember hearing about that critique when, like, Happy Gilmore 2 was coming out. And it was like, well, look at a frame from Happy Gilmore that came out in the 90s. Compare that to Happy Gilmore 2. Happy Gilmore is so vibrant and the colors are so bright and sharp. And it looks so good. And, like, there's the film grain. You have a lot of cool aspects to the visual feel of this movie that are just completely gone with straight to streaming. And it still reigns true with Thursday Murder Club. Aside from that, I'm not going to say much more because I have nothing. I don't remember things about this movie, and I watched it pretty intently. I was excited to watch this. The cast is good. Otherwise, literally anyone could have directed this movie. Telling me Chris Columbus directed this, that is a massive surprise. If I didn't know that going in, I'd be like, you're lying to me. Because this movie is directed on autopilot. No one made this movie. There's no style to it. It's pretty flat. There is some charming dialogue and some bits of humor between the characters. Like I said, the performances are good. And you have a really good cast that has good chemistry. And there's some charm there. Aside from that, this is a fucking coma of a movie. You might as well just sleep for 2 hours as opposed to watching this. There's nothing here for you. Corey, did I sell you on the Thursday Murder Club?
I mean, it doesn't surprise me. It's just a lot of, like you said, those Netflix movies just are made by committee. It feels like, yeah, just pump them out just for more content, not actually for, like, creative purposes. But yeah, Chris Columbus, he's a very interesting director, just because, like, 90s and early 2000s with, you mentioned the Home Alone movies, first two Harry Potters, and Mrs. Doubtfire is great. Like, he was just really cooking there for a bit, and just had a great feel on, like, I don't know, especially, like, young kids in movies and how to direct them really well and get good performances out of them. So, I don't know, kind of interesting that he's going, like, the other end of the spectrum with, like, an older cast and doing that. Yeah, not one that I'm really, like, interested in, you know, doesn't surprise me, and just hearing your review, it's not one that's really on my list to see. Something I caught up on this week, I was really excited about, I've been wanting to watch it for a long time. I know you watched it earlier this year, and that is Predator, Killer of Killers. I have been waiting to get Hulu, because there's a bunch of things I want to watch on there. We'll get to Alien Earth in a little bit. But Predator, Killer of Killers is an animated movie that is essentially an anthology movie. And you have, sort of in the same vein as Prey, where you're going to a different era, a different time period, and a warrior fighting a predator.
Yeah.
So you get a first story of these Vikings, and the second story is of samurais. The third story, you get a World War II fighter pilot. And with anthology movies or shows, there's typically, like, we've talked about it before, one that you prefer more than the others, one that you're like, oh, that's clearly the best, and there's a few others.
You almost automatically fall into, I'm going to rank these subconsciously, even not even, like, attempting or trying to. You're just going to end up having, like, a favorite, least favorite, and then, like, the middle one.
Yeah, and with this, I was actually very happy to report that I really liked all three pretty equally. I liked just the different eras that they chose. I think, like, Vikings and this kind of, like, Norse sort of mythology in there was really cool. I love samurai stuff, so seeing like a lot of just great visuals from that and, like, kind of ninja elements in there. And then just bringing, like, a predator ship with, like, this dogfight that's going on in World War II is really fun, too. I really liked it. And then you get kind of a fourth act of the movie where they all come together. The predators bring them back to their home world, and they have them fight in this little tournament gladiator-style thing. And that fourth act for me, I think, lost a little bit of steam. It wasn't quite as interesting as being in their time periods. Mm-hmm. When they're all together, I like seeing them interact, and I had a good time, but it wasn't quite as good as those first three kind of acts were. But there are some fun, like, teases for what we could do with the Predator movies. There's a couple post-credit scenes in this movie, and one of them is, like, Predators have this, like, sort of, I don't know what it is, like a vault or warehouse or something, and you see like the girl from Prey, you see Danny Glover from Predator 2, and you see Arnold from the first Predator. And that's, I think, kind of part of what works so well about this movie, is that with animation, you can do that, and I'm like, oh, okay, that's fun. That's like an interesting idea if they did want to do.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Do another animated project down the road and somehow bring those characters back, I'm fine with that. Like, that could be okay. If this were to be live action, they did, like, a CGI Arnold in the thing, I'd be like, ah, why are you doing that?
Terminator Salvation Arnold.
Yeah, something like that. So, I think overall, just, like, that idea, but also of this movie, like, being able to do a lot of cool out-there visuals in animation just works so much better than doing it live action.
Yeah.
Because you can really just do what you want to do fully and realize that. So, I enjoyed this movie a lot. Michael Biehn is in the voice cast. He's in the World War II segment, which is great to just hear him. He's got a distinguishable voice. And
now have him a part of the Predator franchise.
Yeah, really Predator, really cool. Terminator, Alien. Him and he's Bill Paxton kind of all being in all three of them. It's cool. So, I really dug this movie. I was telling Mason, I was more excited for this one than Predator Badlands coming out later this year.
Yeah.
Still excited for that movie. But I just think this one kind of nailed what a lot of people were wanting from Predator, of doing something a little bit different and not just doing another, like, people in the jungle fighting a Predator. This is like, cool, go to different eras. And if they even wanted to do another one of these of three more eras of doing something else, I'm down with that too. So, really love this movie. I wish I could have seen it in theaters because it looks great. I really like the animation style. I think it's cool. I know that some people are a little iffy on it. I dug it. But if you're a fan of the Predator movies, would highly recommend this. If you're a fan of good animation, I would recommend it as well, because it's my favorite animated movie thus far this year.
Yeah. No, I'm happy that you finally got to sit down and watch this. This is, like, one of the movies that every time I, like, come over to record, I always, like, did you watch this yet? Did you watch this yet? I'm happy you saw it. The animation, like you said, it is awesome. I love the style of it. I love the distinct time periods. I think between the original Predator from, what, 87... and then Prey, and now Predator Killer of Killers, I think these three films have had the best understanding of what we want in a Predator movie. While I agree with you that the kind of epilogue, or that fourth act, when we get the characters kind of intertwining and, like, on the Predator world and them figuring it out, and they're almost in this gladiator-type scenario, it is, like you said, kind of the lesser of the movie in terms of the what's going on, and it's like, I really just like the specific time settings. I do like the camaraderie of them just trying to figure out how to work with each other. They're like, you're a Viking, you're a samurai, I'm a World War II pilot. Like, none of us have common ground in terms of how we talk, how we work, or how we're gonna get out of here. And I just like seeing them kind of, like, fumble fuck their way out of it. So this is such a very fun and very visually arresting animated film. Again, put it in theaters. Why not? You have nothing. Like, I don't understand. I still don't get the streaming mentality of not putting anything in theaters. You're just missing out on money, basically, by not rolling it out and having at least someone come and see it and support it on the big screen. When I saw it, they didn't have the Dutch and Danny Glover editions. It was just the woman from Prey. What's her name? The actress.
Amber
Midthunder. They just had Amber Midthunder, and I was like, that is a perfect tease, and I love that Dan Trachtenberg is kind of handling his own little trilogy of Predator movies. I kind of also agree with you. Like, I'm excited for Predator Badlands, but I'm like, I don't think it's gonna be as good as this one and Prey. I'm just like, I don't know. I watch the trailers and I'm like, interested enough, but I feel like we've had some really good stuff. I don't know. In terms of what we have coming down the docket. But I'm super excited. This is the best and most consistent Predator projects we've had in a row. So it's just like, wow, hey, who would have thought that an 80s franchise is just going to start killing it randomly in 2020? Or the 2020s, I should say. But I'm happy you saw it. And yeah, having Michael Biehn in this franchise is just, like, overdue at this point. A movie that I bought last week, and I mentioned it on our physical media roundup, was The Warriors from 1979, which is directed by Walter Hill. Again, kind of, I did the show notes on this one. I wanted to throw in specifically films that Walter Hill directed. You have 48 Hours, which is a classic. But
love it.
The movie that stood out to me, and I did not know, completely like blindsided by this, forgot that he made this movie, Bullet to the Head, with Sylvester Stallone and Jason Momoa from like 2013. Or it was like 2011 to 2013. I forget the exact year. I remember that was the action movie I thought that was going to be the end of all action movies, just because I was like, this is it. This is the peak. We have, like, in the trailer, you have like a muscly, shirtless, late 60s Stallone with a gun, just like, oh! And then you have Jason Momoa with an axe, and they have an axe fight. I was like, this movie's going to be sick. I eventually, like, I never saw it when I was a kid, then I watched it when I was an adult. Movie's not good. Really pretty ass, actually, but it's enjoyable for, like, the reasons of the nostalgia that I have associated with it. But I just thought that was a fun thing. I wanted to bring that up. The Warriors is also kind of like this classic gang movie from the 70s, and I feel like there's a lot of movies that, when they come out, the reference point or, oh, this movie's like this and this, or this meets this. I feel like Warriors is a film that always gets referenced in that kind of aspect. It's about a street gang known as the Warriors, and they're having to fight their way back to their territory because every gang in New York is now after them. They had this big council of gangs with the basically their overseer, their head leader, Cyrus, who's bringing all the gangs together. He's like, hey, we have 60,000 gang members and gang-affiliated people that we could completely overrun the New York police, because they only have 20,000 police officers on staff. We can overrun them. And during this big meeting, Cyrus, the head leader, gets assassinated, and the Warriors are the ones that are getting pointed at. They're like, oh, it's the Warriors did it! The Warriors did it! And so Warriors have to just flee back to their home turf and try and survive the night. It's a very fun, I was going to say 80s. It came out in 79, but it feels like an 80s film. And you get so many cool design elements of these different types of gangs. The Baseball Furies are kind of an iconic one of this gang of just a bunch of dudes with long hair wearing like 30s to 40s baseball attire and having painted faces. And just there's a lot of just cool moments within this movie. It's a movie that feels a little dated, but I was never bored by it. There's not nonstop action in this movie. The plot line or the synopsis kind of reads like, oh, they're in fights nonstop. Yeah, they run into like kind of tiffs and they have to get out of sticky situations. There's a lot of chases and stuff. They're dealing with gangs and also the police officers that are after them. It's not necessarily an action movie beat for beat, like, oh, we're nonstop fights. It's just a good chase movie, basically. And I really was endeared to the gang. The gang consists of Michael Beck. We got James Remar in this film. He's one of my favorite parts of this cast. Sadly, his character at a certain point kind of gets sidelined based on his horrible ideas and inhibitions to just fuck himself. But overall, I was really pleasantly surprised by this movie. I remember the thing that tipped me off to this film was, I remember when I was like in middle school, I would go home after school, I would play Sims, I'd eat like a full fucking sleeve of Oreos, watch Good Luck Charlie, and then towards the end of the night, fuck it, I'm gonna throw on Watch Mojo and watch a bunch of random top 10 lists. And I remember The Warriors got brought up, and there's an iconic scene that I remember from that top 10 list that then when it happened in this movie, I was like, fuck yeah, there it is. And there's a scene where the main antagonist has these three bottles, and I believe that this scene was improvised, or wasn't it originally in the script, at least. But he's got three bottles, and they finally show up to the Warriors, and they're cornering them, and they're in a car, and he's got the three bottles. He's just, like, clinking them, and, like, clink, 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 clink. And he's, Warriors, come out to play! And it's just, that scene is so awesome. It sticks out in my head for a lot of nostalgic reasons, like I listed, but also it works so well. That's so ballsy and badass in the scene of just, like, this dude with a whiny voice. The dude's like 5'6", so it's like, you're not physically the most intimidating, but him just, Warriors, just unhinged. It works so well. This is such a fun, it reminds me of like watching The Outsiders, which came out in the 80s, of like just like gangs back in that time. I think that The Warriors sets itself up for a good kind of modern retelling. Not that I think that you could necessarily set it in, like, today's age, but I'm like, you could do, like, a semi-post-apocalyptic take on this and still have, like, a similar story of, like, all right, we got to get through the night. We need to get back home. And all that stuff. But I really dug the cast. I dug this movie. It was a film that I feel like will become somewhat of a classic to me, and I'll watch more and more in years to come. But if you haven't seen The Warriors, Corey, I don't know if you have. If not, I would recommend for you to watch it. I don't know if you're going to love it, but I think it is a good movie and you'd have a good time with it.
Yeah, this is one that's been on my list for a long time. I haven't seen it, but the scenes you mentioned, I've seen some of those iconic lines. Yeah. And Walter Hill, you mentioned 48 Hours. I love both 48 Hours movies with Eddie Murphy and Nick Nolte.
Nick Nolte.
What a guy. He was good there for a while.
Yeah, before he fucking lost his shit.
Even
Gary Busey need to be in a buddy cop movie about buttered sausage.
Buttered sausage. Yeah, that would kill. But I know Walter Hill, he's been a producer on like almost all the Alien movies, I think, too. Yeah. So he's been very involved with those. So, yeah, one I've always wanted to see and will probably check out soon here. Moving into TV stuff, it was actually kind of a big week for me personally, just watching a lot of stuff. We had the third episode of season 2 of Peacemaker. This one, we get Peacemaker going into this alternate dimension, and he meets up with the Harcourt there. We see, again, spoiler alert for this episode if you don't want to know anything. But we see Rick Flagg Jr. We get Joel Kinnaman back. That's great to see. I loved it.
Awesome.
Yeah, he pops up and it's revealed that him and Harcourt had a relationship before he got killed in the Suicide Squad. So that was interesting to see. And just kind of, they mentioned Enchantress too.
Yeah, Jane.
So
I was like, what all are we including now? In my head, I'm like, that doesn't exist, but yeah. Jane as a person exists.
I'm like, wow, we're getting messy here.
Yeah, I'm like, let's
try to figure it out.
Let's not add too much to
this. Is Cara Delevingne showing up at some point in one of these
movies?
For the
love of God, don't.
We'll see, but I did like the bit of Peacemaker going to the office, the Argus office, and Rick Flagg is just like looking over the like dividers at the desks, which is at what they're doing, just like tripping over garbage
he's
cans.
He's a little bit more of like a bumbling version of Rick Flagg, like he was in the army, but now he's just like at a desk and he's like, ah, I told you guys not to have this garbage can here, after he just like kicks it over and shit like that.
So great to see Joel Kinnaman back, love that. And then we get, I think it was the Sons of Liberty, they're called, this like villainous group that were trying to set off a bomb. And Peacemaker stops him, just some cold-blooded kills. It was great. It just in, like, this stairwell, he's just, like, mowing down, just headshots of dudes. Just,
they're all running up on him. It's towards the very end of this big climactic thing, and he just has a boom, 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 boom. Done. Mm-hmm. And it's like, fuck, if Batman could just kill, movies would be done in 5 minutes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So it was a really fun sequence to see. And then we get Keith coming in at the end. Yeah. Captain Triumph, I think, is his actual
name.
Couldn't
have told you that.
So, this world is a little sketchy, though. I mean, I've seen a lot of people speculating on what it is. It feels like it's going to be some weird white supremacy-type dimension.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's kind of the vibe I'm getting from it. But we have a lot of that. Not too much else, like, in the main dimension world.
Yeah, his actual homeland.
We get more of Economos and Argus team kind of starting to go to Peacemaker's house at the end of this episode, teasing that they're going to try and arrest him, and they bring in Michael Rooker as Red Saint Wild to kill Eagly.
How do you feel about that? That is the one aspect of the show where I'm like, what are we doing here? Like, I love Michael Rooker.
Yeah.
But I'm like, he just feels so like, hey, we got Michael Rooker because James Gunn's affiliated to this, so now he's in this show, and we need to give him a weird oddball character that he can kind of be a one-off with. Like, I'm like, what is this?
It's sort of, it goes back to what we talked about last week with Chip Meadows and bird blindness, which I've sort of come around on that a little bit. I think it is funny, but it still just sometimes feels awkward. I don't know. I want to see the season play out with Michael Rooker and be like, all right, do you need to be here?
If he just gets killed in the next episode, I'll be like, why the fuck was this anything?
Yeah.
But
solid episode, though. I enjoyed it. Just setting up some cool questions and seeing where this is going for sure. It feels like this one had a little bit more momentum than episode 2.
Yeah.
Of just kind of putting the story forward. But like we said last week, it's appointment viewing every week. I'm so excited to just see what happens every week because I don't genuinely know what's going to go on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love, like, the best thing about the Peacemaker show is I know fucking nothing about Peacemaker in the comics. So it's a character that I'm like, they could do literally anything with and I'm going to be surprised by. It's not predictable to me. This episode, I love, yes, we get him in that alternate kind of timeline or alternate dimension. I just like seeing characters happy Because, like, we got, like, that first episode when he gets to experience sitting in and drinking with, like, his dad and his brother. And he's like, oh my god, this is what I've been missing out on. He's just, like, kind of happy, but he's sad because he's like, fuck, this is crazy. But being able to just see him in this other universe's Harcourt, and like, oh, you guys got, like, chemistry. Like, you guys are cute. Like, this works. And, like, them just, like, talking. And then, boom, bomb goes off in front of him. Like, oh, it's starting right now. Like, yep. I really dug the pacing of this episode. The episode was maybe one of the shortest ones of both season one and season two, which was, like, maybe my only gripe I really have, aside from the Michael Rooker edition, where I'm like, what are we doing here? But I like where this is leading. I'm excited by it. I love just, like, yes, he's kind of a hero because he's doing heroic things, but he's also just fucking cold-blooded murdering people, too. And it works for a laugh, and I'm like, I get why you can't be, like, a part of the Justice Gang or whatever, like, and within this world. Like, it works so well, and I love how different and distinct he is from, like, typical heroes within, like, the DC universe and, like, the MCU. Like, I just like having a character that he's like, this is my own lane that I get to be in because I'm doing good things, but also I'm just shooting the fuck out of people. Like, and I don't care. Like, it's fine. Whatever his line is in Suicide Squad, he's like, I don't care how many people I have to kill. I fight for
men, women, and children. I'm gonna kill.
Yeah. So I'm a big fan. Again, this is of the shows that are really running right now. A lot of the bigger name ones. This is the one that I'm like the most excited for every week to sit down and watch.
So this week I also caught up on Alien Earth. I've been meaning to do it last week, but I finally did it. I got caught up with 5 episodes now, and I've been digging the show. Kind of touching on both Alien and Predator franchises this week, which was kind of fun to do watches for both. And you've kind of touched on the basic plot points of the first 5, so I won't really dig into too much there. But essentially, this is before the first Alien movie, after the events of Prometheus and Alien Covenant. Not that it really ties into that, but just for a timeline kind of placement. And I like the idea of doing a lot of great world building. I think that's what the show does best, is giving us these 5 different corporations. We've only really known about Weyland-Yutani through the movies. So to see, like, Prodigy is kind of the main other big one, and you have a few other groups that are all kind of battling for control through technology and through different places on Earth and throughout the world. I enjoy that. It expands what we know about the Alien franchise into more. And it also does that with a lot of the creatures as well. We've seen the facehuggers, we've seen the xenomorphs, but we have some cool, like, this little eyeball octopus
tentacle thing.
That can, like, take out an eye of a sheep and, like, or anything and go in there and, like, become, like, take over that being, which is fun. You get these really gross, like, little parasites that go and, like, suck the blood out of somebody,
leeches,
get a little, like, sack of blood. And I'm just, like, there's a scene where I think it's the first or second episode where, like, two guys are tied up to poles and, like, they can't do anything. And they're just, like, feeling this thing crawl. Like, that shit is just terrifying to me. So just, like, cool new creatures. I like, there's some cool, like, new guns and technology. One of the characters, Moro, I think it is, he's my favorite character in the show so far. He's this cyborg that, he's, like, a human who's kind of genetically enhanced. And he has, like, these weapons where, like, one of them is to, like, essentially make a big bag for the xenomorph where he just, like, shoots, like, sprays something and it can transport it around. But then he also has, like, this, like, stun gun, basically, that he can use for stuff, which is something new that we've seen in this franchise, because any other time it's like, alright, well, we can't cut the thing because the acid's gonna go everywhere and we can't, like, if we shoot it, we're gonna kill it. He wants to kind of preserve it a little bit. So, just new things they introduce within the show that I really like. But it does still have that old school Alien feel, even with the logo coming up every week. I love, like, just the part of each letter coming up. Also a great way to do the Previously On segment without saying Previously On, but just, like, having the logo come up, you get a few little flashes of what we saw in last week, and then, like, a little tease of what's coming up, even if it doesn't come in that episode. It's like, ooh, what's coming up in maybe the future? So, great feel to the show, cool new expansion of this world. And I think it does have a good balance of that heady sci-fi where we're getting this Prodigy experimenting on doing these hybrids of, like, a synthetic body but putting a child's mind into it. And they do a good job of differentiating that in the opening text of the first episode where, like, we have humans genetically enhanced, we have fully synthetic androids, and then we have a hybrid of both.
Yeah.
That's a great way to like, do exposition or kind of catch you up on it without feeling too, like, monotonous and all that. So, really like the heady sci-fi stuff they're digging into. There's a whole lot of, like, Peter Pan and Neverland, which, you know, this is now owned by Disney, so it's like, I wonder if that was part of it at all. Also, we get Ice Age, we get Sid. You've probably seen the picture of Sid the Sloth.
Just, like, faded,
yeah, which, like, seeing it out of context, I was like, what the fuck is this? But, like, it makes sense for the show. But you also do get some really good action. You get some good Xenomorph stuff chasing them around, the other creatures as well. The fifth episode is my favorite so far. It feels like that first Alien movie of just, like, the creature's loose, we're trying to figure it out. Mm-hmm. And the ship is also crashing right now, we have to figure that out.
Yeah.
So just a lot of good moving pieces there. Really dig at the show. I think it's a great addition to the franchise. Noah Hawley, the showrunner, seems to just understand and have a love for those original movies. And I really don't have many flaws with the show. I've just really been enjoying it, and I can't wait to see what comes up as far as just expanding this world even further.
Yeah, no, the cast has also been a main, like, positive for me. Sydney Chandler as Wendy has been phenomenal.
Didn't know she was Kyle Chandler's daughter.
I didn't know that until this past week. I was going to bring that up. It just, like, took me by surprise. I was like, no shit, that makes so much sense. Also, the intro is great, using the title, but the song that they play, Strange Brew, like, Kill What's Inside, like, that's been so earwormy, stuck in my head, and then I looked into it. I've been listening to it on my phone a lot. It was written, and Noah Hawley actually does the vocals on that, and it's an awesome song. I listen to it all the time. It's very good. The Essie Davis, phenomenal. Samuel Blanken, he plays Boy Cavalier. He might be my favorite character within this show. He's a complete asshole. Like, he's the worst person, and he knows it. Like, he's a smarmy dick. Like, he's a dickhead. And you buy into it, it works so well, but also, like, the fact that they are having these Weyland-Yutani specimens, these monsters, within their hands, and now he's like, how can we leverage this? Like, they didn't want us to have these. They didn't want anyone to know about these. How can we learn from these and then basically go back and compete with Weyland-Yutani? I like seeing these different five corporations. Also, this last episode being kind of... It does tie in and link up to the beginning of that first episode, too, but also just an Alien show. Like, this is Alien again, not in the sense that it's a remake, but giving us this claustrophobic scenario where multiple aliens within this show, just because we have the different kind of species and stuff, which I do also really like, but a xenomorph hunting down a crew while the crew is trying to figure out their failing situation, and almost everything that they go do, something goes wrong, and then it sets off a thing for next that they have to go try and solve, and then something goes wrong there, and it's so well done. And, yeah, I don't have a whole lot of negatives. Sometimes it's slow, but I'm never, like, bored. I'm always so interested in it. And I have no idea where the fuck it's going. Like, I don't know where this season ends. I don't know what, like, that final scene is. What is the punch of this show? I dig it, though. I'm on board. I've loved it. I'm happy that you got to catch up, because now it's a little bit easier to be like, all right, so this is what's going on. But do you have, like, a favorite? The first two episodes were, up until this past week, my favorite. Of that rescue mission and the ship going down and the kind of the intrigue of all that and the species getting out and all these monsters. But now, the fifth episode, I'm like, all right, this is like nostalgia to me, and also I love Aliens, so being able to see this work so well. Do you have a favorite episode or a favorite aspect of the show aside from kind of, like, outside of it being within the alien world? Do you have a different favorite aspect of it?
As far as favorite episode, the fifth one, I think for me just has... I think the whole show has a great balance, but this one I was just like, oh, this is I love that it can have the heady sci-fi. That's probably, to touch on your other point, like, my favorite part is that it can get into all that kind of big sci-fi stuff, but also still just be like, which is a fun action, just monsters. Yeah. It's fun. And I mentioned the character of Moro. I like getting his backstory with his kid that he left, and just like that for me, I was like, okay, I'm latching onto you now. I understand what you want to do, why you want to do it, and it's great. I also want to shout out Alex Lothar in the show. He plays Wendy's brother.
Yeah.
And he was in Andor. He was Nemec in that show, which I really like. So, yeah, really just solid cast. Timothy Oliphant, didn't mention him, but he's really good too as this synthetic... So just, a great balance of the Alien franchise, both the sci-fi and the action, I think. Kind of a blend of those first two Alien movies, almost, of getting some horror and action, sci-fi. All that stuff is really great. excited to be on the train now to watch these last few episodes week to week. The last thing of TV that I watched this week was The Paper, Season 1. We forgot to mention that it was coming out last week, but I am a huge fan of The Office. We're both big fans of The Office. It's my favorite comedy show of all time.
Best comfort show there is.
It's incredible. It's such an iconic show for at least people of our generation, for sure, of... Like, at the time when it came out, it wasn't a huge thing, but just over time, it's just grown and grown and grown. Jim Halpert, played by John Krasinski, is my favorite character in anything ever. I love Jim Halpert. I think he's great. So I was always going to watch this show, and I was always like, I don't really need this. I think you could do something else, like, even if you did. Like, Parks and Rec is from some of the same creative team, but it's a different show. It's its own thing. I thought you could maybe do that, but they chose to do this as a spinoff. And they very clearly explain how we get from the end of The Office to where we're at now with Dunder Mifflin. Yeah. What happened there? I won't spoil any of that right now. But essentially, this is at the Toledo Truth Teller in Ohio. Domhnall Gleeson comes in as the editor-in-chief, and he's trying to run this little ragtag paper that isn't really successful. A lot of people that aren't journalists that don't really know what they're doing, which is kind of a fun element to it. And maybe because I work in news, just as a journalist myself, I like seeing these elements of like small scale stories, because we don't get to do a lot of like small stories. I'm at a like bigger station, so it's a lot of the big stories. But these people are just like, what's the parking situation at this park? Like, that affects people, and like little things that kind of matter to small town communities that they're digging into. I don't know. I'm kind of surprised by the show so far. I liked it. I thought it was pretty fun. It's not as funny as I hoped it would be. There are a few jokes that I really laughed at. Tim Key has a lot of them. We talked about him in The Ballad of Wallace Island, which is a great movie, but he's really good. I like Chelsea Reese a lot, too. I don't think I've seen her in anything before, but she's kind of the main, one of the main characters, along with Domhnall Gleeson. And it's just a fun little team that you kind of get to love over the course of this first season, at least. It's 10 episodes, and they're all like 25 to 30 minutes. So I was just kind of getting invested along the way. I like the new theme song that they do. Obviously, it's a tough thing to live up to with The Office, just the iconic theme that it has. But it just also kind of kept growing on me over the course of time. And I really like where the first season ends, as just where the characters are at and kind of setting up things for the future. And I think this show has a lot of potential now that it has the premise and the characters set up to maybe dive into a little bit more good joke writing and like being a little bit funnier than this first season was. But I was never bored by it. And even though it wasn't that funny, I was never like, oh, this is bad.
Yeah.
I was like, I still enjoy being with these characters. I like it. I love The Office. I like this show. You get Oscar back as well, so he's kind of a fun little bridge between the two. But I would actually recommend it. I think that maybe a lot of people are like, oh, I don't need a spinoff of The Office. But I think it's worth checking out, and I think that there's a lot of potential for future seasons.
All right. Yeah, I haven't watched it yet. I don't have Peacock, and I don't like ever want to get Peacock, but I think there are some projects and stuff that's coming out that I'm like, all right, well, I might have to. The Paper being one of those projects, just because I'm, like Corey said, a massive fan of The Office as well. So I didn't need this show, but the cast attached to it really works for me. I love Tim Key. So I'll definitely be checking it out sometime soon. I think it's interesting that they dropped a full season of it and not like a week-to-week release schedule or a rollout, basically. So I kind of like that. Maybe I'll just get Peacock for a month and watch through all of it. I feel like based on what you're saying about it, it sounds, a lot of people didn't love the first season of The Office, like, or at least a lot of people look at it as being like the lesser. It's not as funny. They're still figuring out what they're doing. But I go back and watch those episodes a lot, especially basketball. Basketball is one of my favorite episodes of The Office.
Diversity Days.
Yeah, Diversity Days. Awesome.
So good.
So I'm like, I'm sure the show, like, with its first season, especially since, like you're saying, like, all right, the quality's there, the story's there, the comedy's kind of starting to bleed in. I'm hoping that they just kind of increasingly find their footing and especially work that comedy into it more within kind of each occurring season. I'm excited to check out eventually. Like I said, I'm intrigued by the cast, and I like the ties and from what I do know about the ties to Dunder Mifflin, I'm interested in that too. So it's a show I'll probably check out sometime soonish, honestly. Or I could see myself doing it pretty quickly, or I can also see myself waiting until season two comes out, because that's another thing. They greenlit season two, what, after the first, or before the show, before this first season even really aired. So I'm like, you know what, all right, if they're that confident, I'm sure that they have big plans for it. I'm excited to check it out. So maybe I'll wait even to that point so I can watch season one and two back to back. Moving into new releases for this upcoming week of September 12th of 2025, we have a couple of notable mentions or notable movies coming out. The biggest one, I feel like, that it's kind of, at least for me, been everywhere and slowly really seeping it. Like, their marketing campaign's kind of starting to kick in. Also, they did a big special release of it or viewing of it in theaters. But The Long Walk, directed by Francis Lawrence, who did all the Hunger Games movies and Constantine and Red Sparrow? Shit, I didn't know he did Red Sparrow.
Do you like that movie?
I enjoyed that movie. That movie, well, movie made me feel, like, sick to my stomach.
Yeah, made me feel a little sad.
But I was like, fuck, this movie's, like, ballsy. I really appreciate that movie. I don't know if I love it. But Long Walk, starring Cooper Hoffman, who I've really grown to love, David Johnson, who was amazing in Alien Romulus. You got Charlie Plummer, Ben Wang, and Mark Hamill as well. The film is about a group of teenage boys who compete in an annual contest known as the Long Walk, where they must maintain a certain walking speed, which I believe is 3 miles per hour, until the end of this walk, or until they're the last one standing. If they don't, boom, they get shot. The trailers have worked for me. It's based on a Stephen King, I think, short story or novella. I don't 100% know. I haven't read a whole lot of Stephen King. I've read The Shining, and that's basically where it ends. But I'm interested. The trailers look good. Anything that Mark Hamill's in, especially the way he looks in this movie, where he is just outright a villain and just barking orders at these kids. It has a great cast, so I'm kind of won over for that. This is of the bigger releases that we have coming out this week. This is the one that I'm more likely going to go see first. So I'm excited for The Long Walk. Corey, how about you?
Yeah, this is one I remember seeing the... Excuse me. Well,
we're both
had a big
like,
air
we're
bubble.
Both talking through burps right yeah. now. That's why I passed it to you, because I'm like, oh, I can feel my throat.
Right as I was having mine. I remember seeing the trailers a while back and being like, maybe I'll see it or not. I don't know. We'll see. Yep. But then just hearing a lot of good reactions from people that we follow. Enough. Yeah, just saying that it's really good. You know, being a Stephen King project, it's always going to be interesting. Mark Hamill, he's going 2 for 2 with Life of Chuck in this movie. Yeah. Stars Stephen King stuff this year. So this has gone from one that I'm like, I don't know if I'll see, to being like, yeah, I'll definitely check it out this week for sure. It looks very interesting. One long-delayed sequel that we have coming out this week is Spinal Tap 2, The End Continues. I've never seen this as Spinal Tap from the 80s, but it comes from Rob Reiner, who had an insane run in the 80s and 90s. Stand By Me, Princess Bride, When Harry Met Sally, Misery, and A Few Good Men. That's a wild run of such different movies, of like rom-com.
Through multiple decades.
Yeah, of like coming-of-age movie, a fun fantastical adventure, rom-com, horror movie, great courtroom drama. Like, that's awesome. I love like that run of movies. They're honestly just some of my favorites. So I'm very curious about this one. I like Michael McKean a lot from Better Call Saul. Mm-hmm. He plays Jimmy's brother. So I don't know much beyond Turn It Up to 11.
Yeah.
That's like kind of the quote everyone knows, I feel like. So definitely I'm going to watch the first movie this week and go see the new one just because I'm so curious. I don't know how the quality is going to be of the second one, but definitely interested just to be caught up on both of these movies now. Mm-hmm.
I do really like the first Spinal Tap. It's a really good spoof comedy. It's not my favorite spoof comedy by any means, but it is a good film. I think when I saw it, I saw it too old maybe, or I maybe missed the boat on it. It just, I don't have that attachment associated with it. And then I remember hearing like Spinal Tap 2 being in discussion for so fucking long that I didn't even like take it to like being an actual project. And then I feel like it got announced and we got a trailer and now it's coming out all within what feels like a month. I know it's been several years of trying to figure this out, but now it's coming, and I'm like, oh, okay. And it just doesn't feel like a standout movie coming out to me this year. It doesn't feel like, oh, hey, an event film of 2025 is the sequel to Spinal Tap. I'm like, also this is happening. So I'm sure I'll check it out. I like the first one enough. I think it is a pretty good spoof comedy. The trailers haven't like sold me on it, but also I feel like trailers for comedies, it's like ice skating uphill. Like it's a hard task to really sell me on a thing where you can show me like 10 seconds of a joke and get the timing down and make me laugh or really win me over to anything. I'm happy that some of the stuff, like, we're getting a lot of the cast back and Rob Reiner directing. I'm like, all right, Rob Reiner directing. I haven't seen a Rob Reiner directed film in theaters, so boom, here we go. So I'm excited to see that. A movie that I have no interest in seeing, and that's not a knock on this. It's a part of a long-running TV show franchise that's now branched into films. But Downton Abbey, the grand finale, directed by Simon Curtis, is now coming out in theaters. And my biggest connection to the Downton Abbey franchise, book, or movies, TV show, is that of my grandmother, who was like, hey, you should watch this show. I've seen this show. It's really good. And I was like, I won't, because it doesn't feel like my cup of tea, but happy that you love it. And then, not only that, I used to be a manager at a movie theater in Minnesota, and I worked during the last Downton Abbey film release. I forget what that one was called, but it came out in theaters, and our theater was positioned right on the other side of the street from, like, a 55-plus apartment community. The Jerrys flocked across that street to this movie. They fucking, like, our amount of tickets sold per screening of Downton Abbey, whatever that movie was, fucking skyrocketed. And I hope that this movie makes bank. It's not necessarily for me. For it to be kind of the conclusion to the Downton Abbey is kind of crazy to me, because I feel like that's a franchise that's just been going on for so long, whether it's the TV or the movie. So it's coming out this week. I have no connection to this. I've not seen anything of it. I've not been exposed to the story of it. I'm sure it's great. Not necessarily my cup of tea, but hey, you have this to look forward to if you're not really into Spinal Tap 2 or a edgy Stephen King thriller.
Much like you, my grandma talks about watching Downton Abbey. She's like, I love this show. It's so great. Just the British royalty doing their thing. I don't know that I would go back and watch the show, but I could actually weirdly see myself watching these movies and having a good time.
How many movies are there?
There's three movies.
There's fucking three.
Well, this is the third one.
Still.
Yeah, so like the first one was what, 2019? I think Downton Abbey, A New Era was 2022.
New Era was the one that I was, okay.
Yeah, so that one, and then this is the grand finale. But yeah, I don't know. I'm very interested in British royalty and culture and the kings and queens and stuff. I don't know. I just find that interesting, so I think I could get into this. Like, I don't know. It seems like just this like posh and drinking tea and at castles. I'm like, it'd be kind
of
fun.
The charm of that is interesting. Yeah. The royalty of it, I'm like, I'd rather be drowned in like a 3-foot pool than fucking learn about this shit. I'm sorry. It's not for me. And not that it's bad if it is for you. It's just, fair. I think I've missed the boat on that too. So.
Yeah. I think they'll probably have some tributes for Maggie Smith. I know she was in a lot of the other ones, so that could be a nice little send off for her. I don't know that I doubt that she had anything like filmed for this movie at all. But yeah, I don't
know. Paul Giamatti's in this.
Paul Giamatti, he's like, I saw him in the trailer. That's kind of cool. Yeah. I feel like he fits within that. So I'm gonna see the other two movies for sure in theaters. But down the road, if somebody's like, you want to watch the Downton Abbey trilogy, I'd be like, sure.
Yeah, I've only heard great things. Yeah. As like with the show and the movies, so. Again, if you don't want to see Stephen King or Spinal Tap 2, I completely understand if this is the movie that's really kind of suiting your fancy. So go check it out. Go to the theaters. Support whatever movie you want. We have kind of a pretty decently diverse week this upcoming week. In terms of physical media roundup, I did buy a couple of movies this past week, both Criterion Collection Blu-rays of two films that are somewhat classics or films that would kind of be the kind of sense or source of that conversation of, oh, you haven't seen this movie, at least within like film head conversations. Mulholland Drive, directed by David Lynch, who is one of the, not necessarily my favorite directors, but a director that I'm always interested in. I'm always like, Elephant Man I love, Blue Velvet is fantastic. I'm just so intrigued by his work. He's very weird and all this shit is super surreal and outlandish, and Mulholland Drive, I've heard a lot of people say it's his best movie he's ever made. Also, it's his most out there movie that he's ever made. So I'm really interested in seeing that and checking that out this week. I also ordered and got Ikiru. I got both of these movies here. But Ikiru, directed by Akira Kurosawa. I know you've seen this movie. I haven't. This is one of like the big kind of glaring holes in terms of like the Akira Kurosawa filmography that I've missed out on. And I'm really excited about it. We've kind of come off of like a, at least Highest Lows came out, but High and Low was the one that we really kind of resonated with and got to talk about a lot, and that's kind of gotten me more into like an Akira Kurosawa kick, so hopefully I'll watch Akira here soon, as well as Mulholland Drive.
Yeah, I haven't seen Mulholland Drive, but much like you, I really want to check it out. Akira, I watched in school, in college, and in a lot of my film classes, so I love that movie. It is really like a template for like Breaking Bad, almost, of like somebody decides they want to start living when they find out they're dying.
Yeah.
Love that story, and I love the movie. It looks incredible. I love the main performance in there. So, excited to hear your thoughts on it. I think you're going to love it. I could see it being one of your favorite Kurosawa movies for sure. As far as things coming out this week on September 9th, we have quite a bit of things coming out. We have Jurassic World Rebirth, Ballerina, Elio, Materialists, which I was scheduled for a couple weeks ago, but it's finally coming out now in the A24 packaging. Clown in a Cornfield, Ice Road Vengeance, that Liam Neeson movie. Remember that? Hearing about that thing? Huh?
No.
Remember that? I don't either.
Not at all.
I remember seeing the poster or something. The Ritual. Remember that one also? The Al Pacino, Dan Stevens,
that one
priest?
Maybe fucking rent that this week. Maybe also, I'll check that out.
Also, Brideheart.
No, I almost saw that.
Yeah, we I think that was like the AMC screen unseen. We like thought it could have been that.
What were we going there hoping to see?
28 years later,
to see 28 years later, we saw
40 Acres. But 40 we're acres. Like, it was a rated R movie. I'm like, it could be Brideheart. It wasn't.
That was scary. Like, that's directed by Simon West, which the only good thing he's made aside from Con Air is Expendables 2. And I'm like, I don't need fucking anything from Simon West right now.
So if you're just itching to see Brideheart, that's coming out on Blu-ray this week. And then we have the 4K Criterion of High and Low, which I may buy that this November when the sale comes out.
Sale.
And then Ouija on 4K, which is a great movie. Ouija Origin of Evil I love. That's what
I was
going to
say. I'm like, I didn't know you liked this one.
Yeah, the original is not great. It has Olivia Cooke in it, which she's good. But the sequel I really like from Mike Flanagan. But yeah, a big release week. Fun to have a lot of things coming out. A few of these things I'll definitely be buying. I know Ballerina has a few different 4K releases, some steelbooks. Jurassic World has a steelbook. Elio, I think, has one as well. Mm-hmm. So, nice little variety of things coming out this week.
Yeah. Clown in a Cornfield, it would be a recommendation for me to you. Mm-hmm. That was a movie that I was pleasantly surprised by in terms of like horror films from this past year. And it kind of, I know we're dipping into more like the fall time of year, but also Clown in a Cornfield, it gets into that spooky season, but also it feels like a summer movie. So I was really kind of surprised by that movie. I think that it would be a good one for you to check out. Maybe we both watch Ice Road Vengeance and talk about that next week.
That could be fun. Get drunk and watch that.
Fucking horrible.
Yeah, let's do that. Moving into some movie news, want to start off on a sad note. Graham Greene has passed away. He was a very prolific actor, nominated for Best Supporting Actor for Dances with Wolves. Popped up in so many other things, can't name them all, but mainly he was in The Green Mile, Wind River, Maverick, very underrated movie, Die Hard with a Vengeance, Antlers, and then a couple years ago he was in the Marvel show Echo. Just somebody that always popped up, and I don't mean this in like a negative or in a weird way at all, but just in a lot of like Native American roles. He was a very, one of the Native American actors that is just always, like,
recognized,
so recognizable, always great in everything he's in. Him and, like, Gil Birmingham, I just kind of pop up and stuff, and I'm like, you're really great. But not to just, like, subject them to only those roles as being like, oh, you're just that guy. But just in a lot of those, it's kind of where he made his name. But such an incredible actor that was so consistent, so likable, just a softness to him in a lot of his roles as well. So, very sad to lose him, but like we say any week that we talk about someone that passes away, can always live through their work, and especially Dances with Wolves. I remember watching that movie for the first time in college and just being blown away by it. Him specifically in that movie is great. So, you know, there's still a lot of his movies I haven't seen, so I'm excited to watch those down the road and just, you know, appreciate his work and all the great things that he did.
Yeah, no, he was a trailblazing indigenous actor within the Hollywood system, and the film that surprisingly stands out to me the most was Die Hard with a Vengeance. That was a movie I watched a lot as a kid, and I remember he was just like a part of the NYPD, and I was like every time I saw him, I'm like, oh my god, he's one of those character actors where you see him and you immediately recognize him, and you're like, oh my god, he's in this too. So it's sad to hear, but again, we're getting into more of a celebration of being able to look at the filmography and the legacy of this actor. But he'll be missed. He was, again, he was a trailblazer. He was a phenomenal character actor, and he was great in everything I've ever seen him in. So I might have to check out or rewatch. I forgot he was in Antlers. Maybe I'll go back and watch Antlers, especially as we're getting into the spooky season. So maybe I'll check that out. One of the biggest news pieces from this past week, which came out kind of in out of nowhere, just Instagram post, I believe, by James Gunn,
But it looks like David Corenswet will be donning the red trunks happily again for a sequel to James Gunn's Superman, which was set to come into theaters in July of 2027, specifically July 9th. Gunn, who also co-heads DC Films, announced the title for the film will be Superman Man of Tomorrow. And with the original film kind of grossing and still making money, but grossing past $600 million worldwide, it's not a surprise that we're getting a sequel. It is a surprise to me, at least, that we're getting a sequel this soon. Because I feel like I've seen so many reports of like, well, yeah, we have Superman involved in other stuff, but not necessarily like a direct sequel to Superman. So I'm like, what does that mean? And also the artwork that was released with this announcement has, with the Man of Tomorrow, you have Superman and you have Lex Luthor in his like green kryptonite armor and shit. So it's just like, oh, sweet. I'm excited to see the brain match the brawn and see a Lex Luthor that can kick ass, because I really like Nicholas Hoult in David Corenswet and James Gunn's first Superman movie from this past year, so I'm really excited about that. I wonder if them, because Supergirl was originally called Woman of Tomorrow, which I know it's a completely different like comic line, but I wonder if they dropped that Woman of Tomorrow kind of subtitle just because they're like, well, we have a plan for Man of Tomorrow and we don't want these titles to be too similar, so... Just a weird thought, random thought. I'm really excited about this. I love David Corenswet as Superman, so I'm excited to see him again.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, we got Supergirl coming out next year. I think it is just called Supergirl.
Yeah,
now.
It was originally Supergirl, Woman of Tomorrow.
Yeah, and then they dropped
that part. So I'm like, is that because you guys had plans for Man of Tomorrow?
Yeah, so it could be for sure. Yeah, it'll be interesting. I don't know if it was confirmed that James Gunn's directing this movie. I don't think they said for sure.
I think he might be, but I also don't know off the top of my head if that was confirmed.
Yeah, I would assume he would do it, but I guess we don't know 100%. Yeah, I'm excited for it for sure. I like the Superman movie, much like you did, and we'll see. I'm sure he'll pop up in Supergirl to some extent.
Do you think he shows up in Peacemaker?
I think it could happen.
I think he might towards the end of the season.
They've teased that like the last three episodes of Peacemaker were like very cagey about the scripts being released, so yeah. I'm like, who else is showing up in this thing?
We get a Batman in here?
Do we get like some big, like first time casting of stuff?
Yeah,
so,
Wonder Woman?
Yeah, like, that'll be interesting. Excited. Yeah, a lot of big updates from DC. It feels like every week James Gunn's posting something on Twitter that's like, this is happening, this is happening, this happened. I'm like, whoa, all right.
Sometimes I'm like, dude, you're too active to be a studio head. Just chill for a second. Yeah. But also I'm like, I kind of, as a fan, I really appreciate being able to see all these updates so quickly on shit.
Yeah. Moving into some award season stuff. We're getting into that time of year. Love it. With September being here now, a lot of the film festivals are happening. One of the big ones is the Venice Film Festival. And we had the Golden Lion, which is essentially Best Picture at that film festival. And it went to Father, Mother, Sister, Brother, which is Jim Jarmusch's movie. I actually haven't seen a lot of Jim Jarmusch films, but the one that I have seen, Patterson, I really like. I love that movie. And I'm very curious about this one. It has a really good cast, so don't know much beyond that, but I'm sure it'll be coming out within the next year or so. That's kind of typically how these things work, so you know, maybe next award season we'll be talking about this movie. But moving into the TV side of things, this weekend we had the Creative Arts Emmys, which, if you don't know, is kind of the below-the-line categories for the Emmys, for the TV awards. And next weekend will be the actual Emmys of the big awards happening on Sunday night, which I'm excited for. There's so many Creative Arts Emmys, I'm not going to go through all of them. But a few of the big winners from this weekend, The Studio, got a bunch of stuff. One that I was really happy about was Bryan Cranston as the guest actor. I've talked to you about it. He's so funny in the show, and he's great, so I love that he won that. Also, The Studio got cinematography for their Wonder episode, which is just such an impressive episode, so absolutely deserving. Severance, like I mentioned, Merritt Weaver won Guest Actress, which I'm really happy about. She's really good in that show as the wife of Dylan, as kind of with his innie and outie, that whole relationship.
Oh, shit, okay.
Yeah, so she's really good. I'm glad that they recognize her, because I think she's awesome. Also, they recognize the score from Severance, which is awesome, and the title design for this season, which is really cool, too. A few other things just wanted to shout out from these. Andor got a few awards for some costume editing, production design, visual effects. House of the Dragon, season 2, got a makeup award, which I like that second season, so I'm happy it got recognized. Last of Us got a sound editing award. Adolescence got one for casting, cinematography. And then The Penguin got a bunch of good stuff, mainly for makeup, hairstyling, costumes. The prosthetic makeup in that is incredible, so very deserved. Also, the score for that got recognized. That main theme is so good. All that. And then the last point is Rebel Ridge won Best TV Movie, which I haven't seen yet, but I'm very curious about. So, you know, a lot of the big players kind of recognized here. Just wanted to shout out some of them. I'm excited to see the Emmys next weekend, and maybe we'll do... I guess this would be the week to do an Emmys prediction thing. Actually, we could do it before the show next
week.
Yeah,
we'll record Sunday, yeah.
Yeah, so maybe I'll do an Emmys prediction thing but before that. But yeah, so I was pretty happy just to see a lot of these different shows recognized.
Yeah. Back to Father, Mother, Sister, Brother. I'm excited for that. Jim Jarmusch, I'm not, like you, I'm not the most well-versed in his filmography, but I also love Patterson, and I love Adam Driver, which I know he's in this. Cate Blanchett is a phenomenal actress, even though I don't like Tar, and I hate her in Tar, and I wish that movie won nothing. But I'm excited to see this film. I love when, festivals start going around, because this is when I start to hear about the movies that are really going to matter towards the tail end of the year. And those are typically the movies that have a lot of staying power, at least for me. So I'm excited moving as we get more into the fall and the more awards heavy contenders, especially going into the end of the year. I'm not the biggest TV person, so therefore I'm also not the biggest Emmy person, but it is cool to see guest actress go to Merritt Weaver. These are some of the awards that I don't 100% pay the most attention to, but it's cool to hear about. I am, if anything, more intrigued in Rebel Ridge now, because I heard good things when it came out. I also like that the Emmys are acknowledging a lot of straight-to-streaming as TV movies. I'm like, thank you. They're not normal movies. They're not going... unless they go to theaters, obviously. That makes me more excited for Rebel Ridge, so maybe I'll check that out here soon, too. We also had a massive fucking week in terms of trailers coming out. Notably, we had I Like Me, the John Candy doc. We had 28 Years Later, Bone Temple. A trailer for Marvel Zombies, A House of Dynamite, the new Catherine Bigelow film, Wuthering Heights coming, is that Emerald Fennell that did that? And then we also got Die My Love, which has Jennifer Lawrence in that. So a lot of big documentaries. Corey, do you have a favorite of the lot? Are there ones that you didn't see, or ones that really stick out to you?
Yeah, a few of the awards stuff from this year, kind of fall releases, Die My Love, Lynn Ramsey did You Were Never Really Here, which I love that movie. So seeing Robert Pattinson and Jennifer Lawrence just go toe-to-toe in a movie is very appealing. House of Dynamite looks like a really fun thriller. Catherine Bigelow, just this White House, or at the White House, as a missile is coming towards it, from what I can gather. Wuthering Heights looks very interesting. Promising Young Woman and Saltburn are both very interesting movies, and this one I've heard is also very strange and just goes even further.
Yeah.
It's coming out on Valentine's Day next year, so I think we're going to hear a lot of conversation about couples seeing that movie.
Me and my wife will be seeing that opening.
Yeah.
Actually, I dig the trailer. I didn't love Promising Young Woman, but I really did enjoy Saltburn. That's a movie that I'm like, I want a physical release of this, because I would love to own this movie. I think that movie is so stunning visually, and a lot of that carries over into what at least you can see in the trailer for Wuthering Heights. So I'm excited for that. I'm sure I'll be seeing that for Valentine's Day with my wife.
Yeah. 28 Years Later, Bone Temple, about what I expected from it. Still curious just to see how I feel about this other group. Jimmy, I think his name is. And
Jack O'Connell.
Jack O'Connell. And seeing all the characters come back and how we carry that along. I Like Me, the John Candy documentary. I love John Candy. I think he's one of the funniest people to ever be on this planet. So I think this one just looks great and diving into the deeper side of, and the dark side, unfortunately, of his life. And the last one, Marvel Zombies, I think that's coming out soonish, in the next couple weeks. I think it's just a 4-episode thing. But we see Blade in there.
Moon Knight Blade, kind of.
Yeah.
Almost.
So
it's not Mahershala.
It's not, but very interesting to get a hint of it and be is there any momentum as far as the movie goes, or including him in other stuff? But I really like the What If episode, the zombie one. I forget if it was season 1 or 2. But that was one of my favorite What If episodes, was the zombie one, because I just thought it was a really cool idea, and I liked it. So I'm down with this being a little 4-part thing that they put out. And a lot of interesting trailers that are giving a lot of different, kind of avenues to go down with whatever you're a fan of.
Yeah, yeah. I'm like you, I'm a big fan of John Candy, so that documentary I'm kind of sold on.
Nice.
Every time you finish talking, fuck, I need to talk. I need a cough right now. It reminds me of the I Am Chris Farley documentary that came out maybe early 20-teens or whatever. I think that was like a Spike TV documentary too, but I really enjoyed that documentary. Marvel Zombies, I couldn't give a flying fuck about. What If does not interest me. Animated Marvel does not interest me. Just give me movies. Don't even give me a Disney Plus series. Just give me a fucking movie and give me a good fucking movie. And if you want to put Blade in something, make a Blade movie with Mahershala and figure that shit out, because I don't think it's that hard. David S. Goyer has even reached out to you guys being like, hey, I worked on Blade before. Do you guys want me to help you, you fucking idiots? House of Dynamite, I'm avoiding the trailers for that. I heard a lot of good buzz surrounding this film. I'm a big Catherine Bigelow fan. I love Zero Dark Thirty and obviously Hurt Locker, so I'm going to go into this movie as blind as I possibly can. So I'm excited by a lot of these trailers, and a lot of these projects are movies that I'm going to be seeing and shows that I'm somewhat like tapped into, it even though I don't love Marvel Zombies or care much for it. I'm like, okay, well, like, what are they going to do with like the Blade aspect specifically? But yeah, big trailer week. I think House of Dynamite is the one I'm most excited for, and it's the trailer I didn't watch. So.
Fair enough. Yeah, I think that's getting like a limited theatrical release, and then it'll be on Netflix later this fall. Yeah. So we have a new Street Fighter movie coming. I've never seen the original. I don't know anything about Street Fighter.
Never played. I was a Mortal Kombat person. Mortal Kombat kid.
Yeah, I never really played either one. I'm not a huge like video game guy myself, but Street Fighter is, I know there's the Jean-Claude Van Damme movie in what, like 94 or something. I don't know. I don't know much about it, but we're getting this movie in October of 2026. There was a deal struck between Legendary and Paramount, so we got Noah Centineo, Andrew Koji, David Dismalchi, and Jason Momoa, so a pretty fun cast, and something I'm interested in, and it could be something like the 2021 Mortal Kombat, where I hadn't seen any of the older movies, then I watched them before, and kind of enjoyed the world. Mm-hmm. Feels like something I could do with Street Fighter as well, watch the Jean-Claude Van Damme movie before this one, and then getting into, you know, this... Maybe a franchise, maybe not, we'll see. But something I'm definitely curious about.
Yeah, I don't know the most about Street Fighter, but I like the cast that's kind of starting to come out about or surrounding this movie. Also, there are some set photos of Noah Centineo, and I'm like, this dude's fucking jacked, holy shit. So I'm interested enough in like the Mortal Kombat movie, so I'm sure I'll see these as well, but it's not. I don't have a lot of connection to this franchise mm-hmm. either. A franchise I kind of have a big connection to, just because I do love these video games, is Call of Duty, which we officially got word that with Paramount and Skydance now joining up, and Activision also having officially announced a live-action Call of Duty movie, bringing the $30 billion video game franchise finally to the big screen. I know that there was talks of like Steven Spielberg at one time trying to make a Call of Duty movie, which I'm like, why the okay. Okay. But this project was revealed this past Tuesday, and Paramount will be developing and producing and distributing the film, with Activision serving as a creative partner. The studio says that the adaptation will honor the series' rich series's rich narrative and distinct style. The big thing for me is like, what are you going to do to set this apart from just like a standard military or war film? Are you going to introduce a lot of the characters that are kind of popular from the franchise, like Reznov or Captain Price or Soap McTavish? Or what are we doing here? So it's something that I'm interested in, but I'm not, like, excited necessarily. It's more of, like, what are we doing here? Why do we need to make a video game adaptation of Warfare? Like, this could be anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this... I don't know. I think that this could be okay. There's a lot of interesting storylines through the Call of Duty games. Yeah. I know I just said I'm not a big video game guy, but... Playing Call of Duty Black Ops.
Oh, yeah.
That is my favorite Call of Duty game, and the one that you and I play when
play
we're
zombies.
Getting drunk and playing Black Ops Zombies. Like, that game is so nostalgic to me, and I love the storyline in that game, especially. But, like, some of the Modern Warfare games are pretty sweet, too. So, like, there's more hope for this one, for me at least, than, like, other video games where they're like, I don't know, we're doing, like, a Hot Wheels movie, where I'm like,
what's the cars? Story there, yeah.
Like, whatever. But this one, yeah, it's certainly interesting. And I don't know, it could be fun. I hope that they get a good creative team and make it, I don't know, make it, like you said, kind of different than any other war movie that we've seen, for sure. Last little bit of news is that the new Knives Out movie, Wake Up Dead Man, a Knives Out mystery, just had its world premiere at TIFF, the Toronto International Film Festival. Got great reactions there. People have been buzzing about the movie. And we got news that it's going to be coming to select theaters on November 26th, much like Glass Onion, which came out a few years ago. Kind of had a week release. This time, we're going to have 2 weeks in theaters for Wake Up Dead Man, which is great. More people can see it. I think this movie's going to make a lot of money in theaters, much like Glass Onion did when it came out. But I am so excited for this movie. I love whodunits. I love Rian Johnson's take on whodunits. I love the first movie. I love Glass Onion, too. So
Daniel Craig in these movies is insane.
Benoit Blanc. He's great. And the cast for this new one, just like having Josh Brolin, Jeremy Glenn Renner. Close. Yeah, just a lot of really interesting people in there. I like the setting. Like, I don't know, just this like darker, like kind of church-type setting is really cool to me. So excited that it's getting a theatrical release, for sure. I know you and I will both be seeing that. And excited that it's having great reactions coming out of TIFF.
Yeah, I'm super stoked. This is one of the more anticipated films I have for the rest of the year. Sad to say it's a Netflix release, but thankfully we're getting a little bit of a theatrical run with it, similar to Glass Onion, which I also really did enjoy. So I will be definitely seeing this one in theaters as soon as I can, because I'm hoping that that same theater is showing it, like when we went to see it last time. So I'm super stoked. I can't wait. It's, like I said, it's a movie I'm eagerly anticipating and I can't wait to see, especially with all the positive buzz that's coming out from TIFF about it. With all that being said, thanks for sitting down with us and listening to us yap about movies and chug down some Kona beer. This was another episode of Slate Night, the Film Fan Podcast. Be sure to follow us on Instagram and TikTok for more in-depth movie reviews and movie news. I had a very active Friday of posting like a bunch of reviews of shit that I just was so late on. So sometimes they're not the most timely, but we'll get them out eventually. In the world of film, it's not just about what happens on screen, but it's also about who's sitting next to you in the theater.
Also, didn't want to end this episode without pointing out your Josh Dobbs Vikings jersey.
I almost took this off midway through the show because I'm so fucking sweaty. It's so warm in here. But football's back, baby. It's the best time of year. We're getting football. We're getting into the colder weather, sweatshirt weather, and yes, we are Vikings fans, but also the only Vikings jersey I own is a Josh Dobbs.
That's
jersey.
The only one.
Only one I have. Wow. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, this is the third Vikings jersey I've ever owned. I had a Sidney Rice jersey because he was a fucking god, and I had a Percy Harvin jersey.
Nice.
So now I have a Josh Dobbs jersey, which if you're not in on fucking football, sports, or Vikings, yeah, he doesn't play for us, and he barely played for us, but he was really cool. It was a really exciting time.
Magical run.
Oh, yeah.
Four games.
Astronaut when he was just fucking running up and down the field against the Falcons. I was like, whoa, where'd this guy come from? Well, he's actually can't throw the ball downfield, so that's why he's running it every goddamn time.
Now he's a Patriots legend.
I'm a Patriots fan. You have him on your team.
Yeah, they lost today against the Raiders.
So I'm a Vikings fan, but my Chargers beat the fucking Chiefs.
That was great.
That never happens. I've been a Chargers fan all my life, and I fucking, the amount of times in elementary school, I love that we're ending the episode on this, the amount of times in elementary school when I'd stay up late for a Monday night football game against the Chargers and the Chiefs, just for them to go tit for tat back and forth all night for Philip Rivers to throw an interception, pick six, game over, Chiefs win. Every fucking time it's something like that. So it was so nice. Also, I don't like Patrick Mahomes. I'm tired of Travis Kelce, and I'm tired of the Chiefs dynasty. Get them the fuck out of here. Herbert came to play. He started dating Madison Beard. Now he can just fucking sling it and run for 19 yards on a third and long, and he just, dude's cooking.
Dude's a baller.
I'm so excited for football to be back. Chargers starting off 1-0, but more importantly, Chiefs are 0-1.
And what more fitting way to start the season than the Eagles-Cowboys, Eagles dude spitting on, Jalen Carter spitting on Dak.
Yep.
First play.
Awesome.
Well, you know what, if that's not Philly, then I don't know what is.
That's the Philly special.
I was watching the game, I'm like, wow, we're back.
Right into it. This is mid-season antics already. That's sweet.
It's incredible. So I just had to shout out the Josh Dobbs jersey for the audio listeners to just let them know that, you know, he's in our hearts always.
Yeah, Josh Dobbs.
Anyways, for Mason and I, it's Late Night. That's a wrap.